So today I'm going to finish up the Expanding Universe review, which will just take about 10 minutes. And then I'm going to start talking about statistics stuff, like random variables and random fields. And I'm going to start out by reviewing some material. I made some slides in the laptop. And then if there's time, we'll go back to the Blackboard. Okay. So I realized there were a couple of things that I forgot to say last time that I should have said. One is that the FRW metric has rotational symmetry and translational symmetry. And that statement has a converse. There's a theorem that says that if you have a metric with this six-element symmetry group, then it has to take the FRW form. For that theorem to be true, you have to allow the more general form of the FRW metric with non-zero spatial curvature. And there are also some technical assumptions, such as geodesic completeness, the assumption that if you start integrating a geodesic in the space-time, you don't fall off the edge of the coordinate chart after a finite time. Anyway, the theorem is sort of conceptually important, because you might wonder how anyone ever knew to write down the FRW metric in the first place. It looks like kind of an ad hoc assumption. But it's really just a way of, it really just encodes your assumption that there's no preferred location or preferred direction in the universe. And I suppose your assumption that GR is the correct theory of gravity. Under those assumptions, the FRW metric is the only possibility. The other thing I wanted to say, but I forgot, is that when I wrote down this, I said that the lambda CDM stress energy looked like this. Radiation piece, a matter piece, and a cosmological constant piece with the corresponding FRW pressure given by this simple form, where I just put constant W's in front of each of these pieces. And that's true in the approximation where neutrinos are massless. If neutrinos are massless, then it turns out that they behave like radiation. Their energy density scales as a to the minus 4. And they can be included in the radiation part of the stress energy. The problem with that assumption is that we know from neutrino oscillation experiments that it can't be right. There's at least the smallest set of masses that's compatible with the experiments would be to set one of the three species to have zero mass. The second species to have a mass of order 10 to the minus 3 eV. And the heaviest neutrino to have a mass of around 0.05 eV. I forgot the exact numbers. Neutrino oscillation experiments in the lab measure differences between the masses, or more accurately, differences between the squared masses of the species. Interestingly, cosmology is kind of complementary in that it mainly constrains the sum of the neutrino masses. Anyway, if a neutrino is massive, then it doesn't behave as a constant W species. What will happen is that at high redshift, when the mass of the neutrino is much less than the temperature of the universe, say the CMB temperature, then the neutrino will behave as radiation. But at late times, when the CMB temperature, when the temperature of the universe falls below the neutrino mass, then the neutrino momenta will become non-relativistic, and the neutrino behaves like matter and as a component with W equals zero. The overall evolution is, has some complicated functional form that behaves as W equals 1/3 and W equals zero in the appropriate limits. So writing down the stress energy for a massive neutrino is more complicated. The stress energy is no longer the sum of some independent constant W pieces. And working out the details of that is one of the problems on the problem set. Speaking of which, is now on the wiki. If you look on the wiki, I uploaded the first problem set, which I'll have due next Wednesday, and also some references and examples to get you started with Python 2, if you choose to use that as a programming language. And let me just remind everyone that there's no there are no tutorial problems outside of the problem sets. But the tutorials are open. I'm going to be there today from 2 to 3:30, and also Thursday from 2 to 3:30, if you want to just drop in and ask questions about the problems or anything else. OK. So I was almost done with the expanding universe review. I just wanted to talk a little bit about time coordinates. There are multiple notions of distance and time in an expanding universe. So I've written the FRW metric with time coordinate t, the proper time since the Big Bang. All right, proper time, but more accurately, proper time measured by a co-moving observer since the Big Bang. And of course, another time coordinate which is useful is the scale factor, eh? And that's a useful time coordinate because the stress energy has a closed form if expressed using A as the time coordinate. For example, you could write the you could write h squared this way. I'm just writing these formulas as an excuse to give an example of the weird cosmologists variables. In weird cosmologist variables, you could write it like this. So for example, to integrate Friedman's equation, you even though physically you think of Friedman's equation as describing the evolution of A in time, to integrate it numerically, it's easier to think of A as the time coordinate and integrate to get T as a function of A. There's the redshift Z. Which is the same thing as the scale factor. They're just related by a change of variables. So the redshift is defined to be 1 over a minus 1, or equivalently, a is 1 over 1 plus z. Physicists usually use a, and astronomers usually use z. And so an astronomer would say they observed a galaxy at redshift 2, whereas a physicist would say that's scale factor 1/3. But of course, there's no real difference. And then the last time coordinate, which is sort of interesting to talk about, is the conformal time tau. And this is defined by the differential equation. Think of conformal time as a clock which is sped up in the early universe by a factor of 1 over a. And the advantage of that time coordinate is that light cones are at 45 degree angles. So that's one way of thinking about it. So in proper time, the trajectory of a light ray satisfies this equation. This equation says that the physical distance per proper time is c, or 1. If you wanted to show this a little more formally, you could go back to the geodesic equation. For a geodesic, this quantity is conserved, the contraction of the particle's four velocity with itself. And writing that out in FRW coordinates, you would get here, lambda is an affine parameter for the null geodesic. So writing that out in FRW coordinates, you get this. And if you rearrange and cancel the d lambdas, you have this equation. So in a space-time grat diagram, which uses proper time at the time coordinate, would have light cones like this. The equation dt equals 1. This is proper time. But in conformal time, I've just defined the time coordinate tau to cancel this factor of a, so that the trajectory of the geodesic is just dx over d tau equals 1. A closely related statement is that I introduced the FRW metric in proper time, but if you switch to conformal time, then I would get a factor of a squared here. So I could write the metric this way. And applying this change of coordinates, you can see that the FRW metric is conformally equivalent to the Minkowski metric. That just means that I've multiplied the Minkowski metric by a scalar factor, which is allowed to depend on the coordinates. It's allowed to be a function of the coordinates, but it doesn't have any indices. It's a scalar. So that's what is meant when it said that the FRW metric is conformally flat. So there are multiple notions of distance and time in an expanding universe. For example, the age of the universe, meaning the proper age, is 14 gigayears. That's a numerical integration that you all get to do in the problem set. But the co-moving size of the observable universe is a larger number, I think. $46 billion light years. And of course, they're different because if I draw the space-time diagram in proper time, the trajectory is curved. In conformal time, it follows that this distance is still 46 gigayears because I didn't reparameterize x. X is still a co-moving distance. By the way, it's common to reparameterize FRW time, but it's basically never useful to reparameterize the distance or to change the distance coordinate. If you tried, for example, you might think that would be a natural thing to do, to define reparameterize spatial coordinates this way so that the coordinate x prime would correspond to a physical distance. But what would happen if you did that? Sorry, this should be nice. This is just an aside. As an aside, what would happen if you did that is that you would introduce time-space terms in the metric, which are not very intuitive. Another way of saying it is that you, in order to perform this coordinate transformation, you have to choose an origin to a spatial origin to rescale around, and that would appear to break the translation symmetry of the FRW metric. So we basically always draw space-time diagrams and co-moving coordinates, think of displacements and co-moving coordinates. Okay, so this distance has to be the same in the two diagrams. And in conformal time, the light cone is at 45-degree angles. it follows that the conformal age of the universe is the same thing as the size of the observable universe, or 46 GigaYears. Generally speaking, you can think of conformal time as a distance, a co-moving distance along the light cone. Or, in other words, the conformal time between two time slices is the co-moving distance that a light ray would travel between the two time slices. So conformal time is often useful. For example, we do lots of, in observational cosmology, we do lots of calculations which are integrals along the past light cone. Like if you want to calculate an observable quantity like the weak lensing gravitational shear in a particular direction, you can write it as an integral along the past light cone. And it's usually just easier to do that in conformal time when the equation of the light cone is simpler, and you can think of you can interchange the time coordinate along the light cone with the distance, the spatial coordinates. As another example, the wave equation. If I had a scalar field in space-time, then its wave equation would look a little simpler in conformal time. Okay. So that's all I have to say about the FRW metric. Are there any questions so far? It's all still review, I guess. So next I want to, so I'm told if I just declare to the AV gods that I want the screen to come down, then the AV gods will make it happen. Let's see if it works. AV gods, lower the screen. Oh my god, I'm going to become an AV atheist.
God works in mysterious ways.
Oh, faith is restored. okay, so first I put this, I wanted to say that I put this Google form online. I was going to put this URL on the wiki, except that I forgot, so it's not there now, but I'll put it on the wiki after class. So in past years, I've just found it really useful to like offer this form so that people can provide running feedback. These three questions are like the three knobs that are easy for me to adjust during the lecture. And miscellaneous comments are also really useful. Like last year, I remember one of the more useful comments that I got was just to say that the last lecture was a disaster. No one knew what I was talking about, and I should find another way of explaining the material. And I thought about it and thought of a better way, and everyone is happy. If you want to just, if you ever get inspired to offer some feedback, then just feel free to fill out that form. So I'm going to talk about a little bit about random variables. And where I'm going with this is I want to talk about random fields, because random fields are everywhere in cosmology. Many cosmological calculations are just calculations involving random fields. But experience has shown that so a random field is a multivariate random variable in a huge number of variables that would correspond to all of the pixels in an image or all of the 3D locations in space. And experience has shown that it's just kind of useful to build up that abstraction incrementally, starting with like a 1D random variable. So that's a fairly early starting point. So I like doing it in slides so that I can, in general, I feel like slides are kind of a lecturing trap, because they make it easy to feel like you're covering a lot of material, but you're really just racing through it too fast. But for reviewing the machinery of random variables that you guys have most likely seen before in one form or another, or sort of absorbed it informally, then I think the slides are a good format. Okay. So the setup here is that the standard model of cosmology is a probabilistic model. It doesn't tell you how to calculate the specific CMB realization that we see in our sky, but it describes the probability distribution of all CMB realizations. So random variables are everywhere in cosmology. And I want to start by talking about one-dimensional random variables. So a physicist's definition of a one-dimensional random variable is that it's just anything with a probability distribution function, or PDF, P of x. So the units of P of x are inverse x, and P of x means probability per unit x. So to accumulate probability, you integrate over x with a factor of p put in. And a running example that I'll use throughout the first few slides is this sort of arbitrarily chosen weird one-dimensional PDF. So here's a histogram. I just, on the computer, I simulated a million samples from this PDF. And the histogram of these samples is consistent with the PDF in the sense that the fraction of samples falling into a particular bin agrees with the result of integrating the PDF from one edge of the bin to the other. So the integral of the PDF is the probability of the random variable being in a certain range, and the PDF must satisfy the property that its integral over all values of x is equal to 1. Physicist's definition of a multivariate random variable is anything with a joint PDF, which is a function of n variables. And now the PDF represents probability per unit n volume. So here's an example of a multivariate Gaussian, where in the left-hand plot, the two components x1 and x2 of the random variable are statistically independent. So the error ellipses are circles that are aligned with the axes. In this example, the joint PDF of x1 and x2 contains a correlation between the two components. And I'll define the multivariate Gaussian more precisely in a few slides. I didn't say formally what it meant for two random variables to be independent, so here's the definition. Two random variables are independent if their joint PDF factorizes as the product of the individual one-dimensional PDFs. So if you have a PDF, you can calculate expectation values. And expectation values are just calculated by integrating some function that you want to take the expectation value of times the PDF. And some properties of expectation values that are so intuitive that it's easy to use them without realizing that you're invoking a property are as follows. The expectation values are additive. If I have the sum or difference of two random variables, then the expectation value is the sum or difference of the individual expectation values. If I have a random variable times a constant, I can pull the constant out of the expectation value. And a little more generally, if I have the expectation value of a product of two random variables, then it factorizes as the product of the individual expectation values in the case where the random variables are independent, but not in general. And in fact, we'll introduce the definition, the covariance, to key, which represents the difference between the left-hand side and the right-hand side here, and quantifies how correlated x and x prime are. So going back to this running example, I calculated the expectation value of x and x squared and got 0, which is obvious by symmetry, and 1/2. We'll often construct new random variables from old ones. So for example, given this toy one-dimensional PDF x, I can take two random variables, x1 and x2, which are independent samples from this PDF, and add them together to get a new random variable y, which will have some new interesting PDF, which I didn't try to calculate analytically, but just simulated on the computer and made the histogram here. And you could add 3 together, 4 together, and so on. And as everyone knows, as you iterate this process of adding x's together, then eventually you get a Gaussian random variable. You can see that after I add 20 x's together, even though I started with this weird probability distribution, the universal bell curve or Gaussian emerged. And it Gaussianizes pretty fast, even after like adding 5 together. Even though the initial distribution is really non-Gaussian, it looks pretty Gaussian. And after 20, it's visually indistinguishable. So I want to talk about this Gaussianization process. Gaussian random variables are really important in cosmology. So I want to talk about this Gaussianization process in a little more detail, including where exactly this functional Gaussian functional form comes from, including the factors of 20 and pi. Okay. So first, a few definitions. The mean of a random variable is just its expectation value, and the variance is this quantity. In the statistics books, there are always two formulas written for the variance, and it's actually kind of useful to know that the variance can be written either as the expectation value of the square minus the square of the expectation value, or the result of subtracting the mean, then squaring and taking the expectation value. So the mean and the variance are just, for a one-dimensional random variable, are just the first two moments of the PDF. The variance can be interpreted as the squared size of typical fluctuations around the mean. And the mean and variance have an additivity property. The mean is commutes with adding or subtracting random variables together, which is sort of obvious. The variance has the property that if I add or subtract random variables, then the variances add, but only if x1 and x2 are independent. In general, there would be, in a more general situation, there would be another term on the right-hand side, the covariance of the two random variables, which I'll define later. Okay. So going back to this toy example where I started with an x that had this PDF, and defined a new random variable y by adding n independent x's together. By the way, as I iterate through these plots, I'm rescaling the axis by a factor, the x-axis by a factor of square root n. Even though these PDFs are all visually fairly different, the mean and variance behave in a simple way. The mean is always equal to 0, and the variance is always equal to n over 2. You just, when I add these independent random variables together, the mean and the variance are just going up by factors of n. You can also see, of course, that the mean and the variance for a general PDF contain a lot less information than the full functional form of the PDF. They're just the first two moments. Now, the central limit theorem is a super important theorem in statistics. And here's its formal statement. The sum of a large number of independent, identically distributed random variables, such as the y example, where I'm adding together independent, identically distributed x's, has a PDF which is approximately Gaussian. I'm going to omit the proof, even though the proof is kind of interesting and calculational. And in the course of the proof, this functional form of the PDF will emerge. If the central limit theorem applies, then you know that the PDF is given by this functional form, and it has two parameters, a mean x bar and a variance sigma squared. And the important property here is that if the central limit theorem applies and your PDF has been Gaussianized, then you only need to know two numbers to determine the entire PDF, the mean and the variance. So that's what's happening in this example. The mean and the variance are behaving in a simple way. They just are 0 and n over 2. And then in the large n limit, that's enough information to fill in the parameters y bar and sigma squared in the Gaussian and get this form of the PDF. So Gaussian random variables are ubiquitous in experimental subjects. For example, the noise in any sort of detector will probably be described by a Gaussian random process to a good approximation. And that's because the noise in like a resistor, say, can be viewed microscopically as the sum of a bunch of uncorrelated thermal fluctuations. The central limit theorem applies. Okay, so now I want to talk about multivariate random variables. Here's a numerical experiment similar to the 1D case, where I'm going to start with this toy example of a two-dimensional random variable, where the random variable here is a two-component vector. Where the two components are sort of maximally non-independent. The joint PDF is a delta function along this circle. The little wiggles in the curve here and the color variations are just plotting artifacts. So here's a little numerical experiment where I sampled that 2D PDF. And now I'm making a new two-component random variable y by taking two x's and adding them together in the vector sense. So if I add two together, three together, and so on, then I get a sequence of probability distributions, which you can see are Gaussianizing. So after I add 10 together, I get a multivariate Gaussian to a good approximation. Now visually, you can see that in two variables, the multivariate Gaussian is going to have five parameters. There are two like translational parameters or means that describe that locate the center of the ellipse. And then to describe the extent of the ellipse, we're going to need three parameters. There's an extent of the ellipse along the x-axis, an extent along the y-axis, and then a tilt or a parameter that describes how correlated the two components are. Now, generally speaking, in n variables, the mean is still an n-component vector, but the variance generalizes to a symmetric n by n covariance matrix. So in two variables, the mean would have two components, and the covariance matrix would have three components. A symmetric two by two matrix is three independent components, which is consistent with accounting from the previous slide. The covariance matrix can be interpreted intuitively as follows. The elements on the diagonal of the n by n covariance matrix are variances. And they're just the squared sizes of characteristic fluctuations in the ith component of the random vector around its mean. And the off-diagonal covariances just quantify the level of correlation between components I and component j of the multivariate random variable. If you rescale an off-diagonal covariance by the square root of the associated variances, then you get the so-called correlation coefficient, which is between minus 1 and 1. So here's a picture. Here's a picture that illustrates this for a two-component Gaussian. I've drawn the level contours of the PDF of the joint PDF, or the one sigma confidence region. And if I keep the so focusing on the black ellipse, say the extent of the ellipse along this axis would be the square root of the diagonal variance C11, and the other extent would be the square root of C22. And then the little r here is the correlation C12 over the square root of C11, C22. And if I leave the variances or the diagonals of the covariance matrix fixed, and then I vary that correlation or I vary the off-diagonal element over its allowed range, then I describe this sequence of error ellipses that go from 100% anti-correlated to uncorrelated. The purple curve is what you would get if the off-diagonal element was 0 to 100% correlated. And in n dimensions, you can think of the n by n covariance matrix. The diagonals is telling you how much each component of the random variable fluctuates. And the off-diagonals are giving you, for each pair of components, I and j, some measure of the correlation.
I have a question. The different signs, like positive and negative, what can we associate them with?
Negative r means anti-correlated.
Okay.
And positive r means positive. I've been plotting and talking about multivariate Gaussian random variables without writing down the functional form of the PDF. So here it is. A multivariate Gaussian is described by two parameters, a mean x bar and a covariance matrix Cij. And its functional form is given here. You can note that the inverse of the covariance matrix appears in the PDF, the matrix inverse. The determinant of the covariance matrix appears. The overall prefactor here is just there to satisfy the requirement that the integral of P be 1. And those properties will be important later, the inverse and the determinant. So in cosmology, we're usually interested in Gauss, not always, but usually interested in Gaussian random variables. And so in calculations, it usually suffices to keep track of the mean and the covariance. If the PDF is a multivariate Gaussian, then that vector and that matrix will fully determine the statistics. So for example, going back to this toy example in two variables, you can calculate analytically the mean and the covariance matrix. And as in the 1D case, they just the mean and the covariance matrix are just going up by a factor of n as I increase the values of n. And for small values of n, even though the mean and the covariance are behaving in a simple way, the PDF is complicated and is not determined by those quantities. But in the large n limit, the central limit theorem takes over, the distribution becomes Gaussian, and I know the complete functional form of the PDF. Now the CMB is a multivariate Gaussian random variable. So what I mean by that is that if I take this map, this map for a modern CMB experiment might have like 10 to the 7 pixels in it. And imagine that I take that sequence of 10 to the 7 numbers and flatten it out into a big vector with 10 to the 7 components. Then that multivariate Gaussian, that multivariate random variable in 10 to the 7 dimensions is described by an n by n covariance matrix that can be calculated from physical first principles, calculated numerically. The calculation is very long and complicated. And that perfectly describes the statistics of the CMB. In other words, if I were to give you that 10 to the 7 by 10 to the 7 covariance matrix, and you were to draw a multivariate Gaussian random variable from that covariance matrix, and plot the resulting length 10 to the 7 vector as a map, then that would be statistically indistinguishable from the real CMB, as far as anyone knows. Now, something that I think is really physically interesting is that, and in fact, the Gaussian-ness of the CMB is something that's really easy to see directly from the data. For example, if you were to take this map, like download the Planck map, and just histogram every pixel, the CMB temperature in every pixel, then you'll get the Gaussian bell curve like perfectly to within 0.1%. Or as another example, if you were to take all pairs of point at a fixed separation, let's say I fix a separation like 30 degrees on the sky, and take all pairs of points with that separation, and histogram their joint two-dimensional PDF, then I'll get a perfectly multivariate Gaussian random variable. The level contours will look like perfect ellipses. Now, if you didn't know any physics, but you had measured the CMB and empirically determined this to be true, then I think it would be natural to guess that the reason that that's true is that the central limit theorem somehow applies. That maybe the initial conditions of our universe are built up by some sort of compound process, which is the result of adding many uncorrelated contributions together. That's not what happens during inflation. During inflation, the perturbations are generated quantum mechanically, and the Gaussian-ness arises for a reason that traces back to the ground state wave function of a harmonic oscillator being Gaussian. And just seems to be kind of a coincidence that the ground state wave function of the harmonic oscillator has the same functional form, e to the minus x squared, as the Gaussian PDF in statistics, which comes from a completely different calculation proving the central limit theorem. I think that's physically interesting. So we're going to be interested in, the universe is a pretty Gaussian place, especially the early universe. So we're going to be interested in Gaussian random variables in large numbers of dimensions. So it's kind of useful to think of the mean and the covariance matrix in a covariant way. In this slide, I want to state the behavior of the mean and the covariance under coordinate transformations. So imagine that x is an n component random variable, and I multiply x by an m by n matrix to obtain an m dimensional random variable y. So that could be, A could be a square matrix if I'm like rotating coordinate systems, or it could be a rectangular matrix if I'm like projecting out information. For example, if I took the 10 to the 7 dimensional CMB and just selected a pixel and threw away the remaining pixels, then that would be a 1 by 10 to the 7 matrix, which is all zeros except for a 1 in a particular coordinate. It's an easy calculation to work out how the mean and the covariance matrix transform. The mean just transforms with one factor of the matrix A, which is intuitively obvious. The covariance is a little more complicated, but if I start with the definition of the covariance of Y here, and then I put in these factors of A, then I can bring out the A's by the rule that says that I can always bring a constant. If I have a constant appearing in an expectation value, not another random variable, I can bring the constant out. And so I get two factors of A multiplying the covariance matrix of X. And in index-free notation, I could write the transformation law this way. The covariance matrix transforms with an A and a sandwich between an A and an A transpose. Note that A transpose appears here, not A inverse. Well, A inverse wouldn't always make sense because A doesn't have to be square. This is the same transformation law, by the way, as the metric in general, if A were the Jacobian of the coordinate transformation. Okay, so it's a lot of statistics problems involving means and covariances or Gaussian random variables where the mean and covariance is all you need to know are really linear algebra problems in disguise. And it's really useful to think about things in this covariant way and bring in your linear algebra toolkit. So I have a few examples in the next few slides. Oh, wait. Sorry, I forgot about this slide. Another super important theorem that we're going to use all the time is that if I apply a... So this transformation law that I derived in the previous slide applies to an arbitrary random variable, whether or not it's Gaussian. An important theorem is that if X is Gaussian, and I apply any sort of linear multiply by a matrix or apply any sort of linear operator, then the resulting random variable Y is also Gaussian. So that's why, for example, if I take a CMB map, which is a multivariate Gaussian, and histogram all the pixels, I get the one-dimensional Gaussian distribution. Because the operation of taking a single pixel from the map is a linear operation. If I have a CMB map and I take a pair of pixels at a fixed separation, then the result is a two-dimensional Gaussian. Because the operation of taking two pixels out of a large number of pixels is a linear operation. In particular, so this theorem is true if A is... whether A is a square or a rectangular matrix. In particular, it's true in the case where A is a square matrix and the operation here is just a rotation of the coordinate system or a change of basis. And so the Gaussian-ness of a random variable doesn't depend on a choice of basis. You can think about a Gaussian random variable in sort of a covariant way. So here are some examples. I want to think about the question of how to simulate on the computer a Gaussian random variable with a specified covariance matrix C. Let's just assume that the mean xi bar is equal to 0. To define the problem a little bit better, let's suppose that you know how to do this in one dimension. So if I have some function that I can call that will sample draw a random sample from a one-dimensional Gaussian PDF. And let's also imagine that you have a complete linear algebra toolkit, so you can do things like invert matrices without coding them up from scratch. I think this is hard to get on this, a hard question to answer on the spot if you've never seen it before, but just for fun, does anyone have a proposal for how you would generate a multivariate Gaussian? If you were given, say, a 10 by 10 covariance matrix, how you would generate a 10-component multivariate Gaussian as a specified covariance matrix?
probably need to diagonalize the covariance matrix.
Yeah, that is one possible answer. So there's more than one way to bring in a linear algebra toolkit here. One possible answer is to diagonalize the covariance matrix. So there's a theorem from linear algebra that says that I can take any symmetric matrix C and find a rotation R so that C is obtained by rotating, in this sense, the diagonal matrix lambda. Rotation matrix means that its inverse is equal to its transpose. If I think about that covariantly, I'm starting with my dense covariance matrix C, and diagonalization gives me some change of coordinates that will make the covariance matrix diagonal. If I have a diagonal covariance matrix, that just means that the different components of the multivariate Gaussian random variable are independent. And I can simulate a diagonal covariance, a multivariate Gaussian with a diagonal covariance matrix by just simulating a Gaussian random variable in each entry and then scaling it by the square root of the appropriate variance. And if you want to check formally that that works, here's the formal check. If I simulate a Gaussian random variable y with covariance matrix lambda and then rotate x equals ry, then I can check using the transformation law in the previous slide that the covariance matrix of x is, according to my general transformation law, is r times the covariance matrix of y times r transpose. And then the covariance matrix of y by construction was lambda. And since r is a rotation matrix, r transpose is equal to r inverse. And I do get C, and the proof works. A visual way to think about this is that in two dimensions, you can always sort of visualize a covariance matrix by thinking about the associated error ellipses. In two dimensions, for an arbitrary covariance matrix, what I want is to draw a random variable from a multivariate Gaussian that has some crooked ellipse like this. And by an appropriate rotation, I can line that ellipse up with the axes of the coordinate system. Then I have a Gaussian where the off-diagonal covariance is zero, and the two components of the Gaussian are statistically independent and can be simulated independently of each other. And diagonalization is just kind of an n-dimensional generalization of this process, where if I start with an ellipse in n dimensions that has arbitrary non-zero tilt along every pair of axes, then I can find a n-dimensional rotation that lines up the principal axes of the ellipse with the axes of the n-dimensional coordinate system. Isn't it fun how powerful the linear algebra toolkit is in dealing with multivariate random variables? But wait, the fun doesn't end there. There's more than one answer to this question. Here's another answer. You could have Cholesky factorized C. So another thing that you can do in linear algebra is take an arbitrary symmetric matrix C and write it as LL transpose, where L is lower triangular. And then if you took a unit Gaussian random variable, that is a random vector yi with covariance matrix equal to the identity, and multiplied it by L, then you can check that the covariance matrix of the vector that you get is equal to, this should have been C at the end. It's a typo on the slide. But the covariance matrix of what you get is equal to C. I felt morally obligated to put this in since Cholesky factorization is a little faster on the computer than diagonalization. So this is what you should actually do if you need to do this in your code. So there's actually lots of different. This question can be answered in several different ways using different factorizations and tricks from linear algebra. Here's another example. Let's think about how to prove this theorem. This is a theorem in every statistics textbook that for any random multivariate random variable xi, The associated n by n covariance matrix, well, one thing that I said before is that it has to be a symmetric matrix. But there's another constraint that additionally has to be satisfied, that the covariance matrix of any random variable has to be positive definite. What I should have said on the slide is positive semi-definite. So recall from linear algebra that a symmetric matrix is defined to be positive semi-definite if all of its eigenvalues are greater than or equal to zero. So does anyone have a proposal for how to prove this theorem? Well, how about in the one by one case? If I have a one by one covariance matrix, then the theorem would say that this single element in the one by one matrix has to be greater than or equal to zero. Now I said without really deriving it that the statement that variances, so in the one by one case, this matrix element would just be the variance of the random variable. So I said without really deriving it that the variance can be interpreted as the squared size of fluctuations around the mean for an arbitrary random variable, which would certainly suggest that variances always do have to be non-negative. But does anyone see a formal proof?
It's the expectation value of something squared.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. So the one by one case, C11 is a variance, which is the expectation value of something squared. And therefore, has to be greater than or equal to zero. Okay. Now, how would you get? So that's the proof in the one by one case. How would you get from that statement to the proof in the n by n case?
Well, you know, if it is diagonal, you can write it as two sums of squares, and you can always diagonalize. Is that the? Is related to that?
That's basically right. Yeah, you could always diagonalization. This means that you can rotate, starting from an arbitrary covariance matrix, you can rotate to a coordinate system where the covariance matrix is diagonal, where these lambdas are the eigenvalues of the original matrix. And so by the same proof as in the 1D case, each of these lambdas has to be greater than or equal to zero, which is what we're trying to show. And I put a slide where I wrote out the details of it. So this, by the way, a covariance matrix has to be symmetric, and it also has to satisfy the constraint that it's positive definite, or all its eigenvalues are greater than or equal to zero. And those turn out to be the only constraints that a covariance matrix has to satisfy. If you have an arbitrary symmetric positive definite covariance matrix, then the Gaussian PDF makes sense, and there exists a probability distribution with that mean and covariance matrix. Just as one more little aside, earlier I had stated that I had defined the correlation coefficient, which is just a rescaled version of the covariance. And I had stated without proof that that always has to be between -1 and 1, where the extreme cases -1 and 1 correspond to the cases where the two components of the random variable are 100% anti-correlated or 100% correlated. And so to prove this, there's again a linear algebra proof to prove that this correlation coefficient is always between -1 and 1. You could use the theorem from linear algebra that if a matrix is positive definite, then its determinant is always greater than or equal to zero. And if you write that out, and rearrange, you'll get the condition that the square of r is less than or equal to 1, which are equivalently r is between minus 1 and 1. I love linear algebra so much that I got a little carried away and put an alternate proof in the slides. So it's an alternate proof. You might recall from linear algebra that a matrix is positive definite if and only if every vector matrix product of this form, B transpose CD, is greater than or equal to 0. That's an alternate characterization of positive definite matrices. It's equivalent to all the eigenvalues being greater than or equal to 0. And then if you notice that this, comparing with our earlier transformation law, you can notice that a vector matrix product of this form can be interpreted as the variance of a random variable derived from x by putting in a factor of B transpose. If y is v transpose times x, then our transformation law says that the variance of the one-dimensional random variable y is v transpose times the covariance matrix of x times v. And as we noted previously, variances are always non-negative. That completes the proof. So that finishes the slides, and that's perfect because it's 12:30. I think this finishes like the review part of the class. I just wanted to review the machinery of random variables, including multivariate Gaussian random variables, in kind of a matrixy covariant way so that you can see that the subject is mostly linear algebra in disguise.